first on my side, very pleased to be here. My name is Bernhard Schnittke. I come from the European Commission, and I am somewhat involved with open source applications, open source issues, but not an expert. My point here today is to preempt some of the points which might come up tomorrow, to talk about why are governments interested in open source, what are the big questions from our side, and to give you a perspective from the European level. You will get additional points of view from member states tomorrow, so that will probably give you some other insights, some other ideas of what countries want, or what they are, what the big topics are when they discuss open source. The structure of my presentation, three things, and I do need to go through all three of them. Of course, the last one is probably the most interesting to you. How does open source software fit in with e-government? How does the European Commission, for instance, get involved with open source? But in order to put that in context, I would like nevertheless to talk about first e-government, what are the objectives of that, and secondly about my own program where I come from, IDA, interchange of data between administrations, what it does and how it does it. Now, one of the reasons why I'm very pleased to be here today is because there are, I think, misperceptions on the public side, on the open source developer side, and of course also on the public administration side, of what open source is about, where it can benefit, and what arguments can be put in favor of that. And this is just the a very schematic presentation of the different aspects of open source which can figure in policy reviews or policy analysis of open source. And it's important to keep these, to distinguish these, because if I take my own example, I come from, say, the business economics perspective. We take a very narrow-minded view on open source. We look at what open source can do for the, say, reliability, but also the efficiency of public administrations in our case. You can take different points of views. You can take a point of view, a societal point of view. You can look at what is the benefit of open source for, say, the learning capacity of people. What is the benefit of open source for science in general? You can also take a macroeconomic point of view, which is also a very political point of view, and ask the question, what is the contribution of open source towards competitiveness of, say, the European economy? Or what's it do towards innovation in the economies? These are different perspectives on open source, and it's, on the one hand, it's important to keep these apart, because, as I will try and point out to you later on, our interest is very much business economics. How can I make the public administration more efficient? And if you then come with, say, societal concerns, I have to say, well, sorry, but that's not my kind of, that's not what I'm here for, that's not my competence. That's something to talk to somebody else, probably. But it's very compartmentalized from that perspective. On the one hand, as I said, it's important to keep these things apart. On the other hand, I have to say self-critically that you also, I do encourage you to bring these together in your argumentation. Why? Because governments or people like myself tend to take the easy line and say, well, I don't want to know about what's happening elsewhere, what can be the impact of open source on society or on competitiveness in general. I just want to know what it does for my public administration. But doing that, you will have to look at, as a public administrator, somebody from from government, you do have to keep in mind the broader impact of what you're doing, the broader impact of, say, the applications that you impose on the users, on the citizens and the businesses, for instance. Anyway, this is just to keep it in, this might serve as a structure later on. If there are any questions on my presentation, I would probably say not my competence, or yes, I can reply on that. But that's simply to put the discussion, or my presentation now, into context of the different perspectives on open source. Now, as I said, I'd like to talk about first a little bit e-government in Europe. Why are we why are we talking about information technology in governments? Why are we talking about open source when we talk about information technology in governments? Why are we talking about information technology in governments? Well, I go back to the 1980s and the European context, which is that of creating a single European market. And the single European market is about promoting what we call in our European slang the four freedoms, mobility of people, mobility of capital, goods and services. Now the idea was, as you probably all aware, for those of you that come from the European Union, to create a single European market to do away with the barriers to these freedoms, to this mobility. And you would think on the one hand, okay, that's less government, that means less cooperation, that means less need for IT, but in fact the opposite is true, because if you break down the barriers to, say, the free movement of capital, at the same time you will want to build up barriers, or you want to build up cooperation that looks at money laundering, for instance. If you want to improve the mobility of people, at the same time you will have to look at how to increase cooperation in order that those who work in one country and then move to another get their pensions in the end paid out where they stop working, that kind of stuff. So the four freedoms have been a driver in cooperation between different European administrations, or shall I say administrations at various levels in the member states. Now you have to, the difference between that and that's why I'd like to bring this up here, the difference between single market objectives as a driver of IT and Europe is that the single market objectives were a very internal looking motivation for applying information technology. You're, as I said, you're encouraging the freedom, the mobility of capital, goods and so on, and at this end, and by doing so you're looking at what are the barriers to that and what do I need to do instead when I break down those barriers to protect the businesses and the citizens against dangers that come from increased mobility. Europe is to some extent rather, or has a different agenda than that. Europe is aimed at creating or making out of, it is a very sort of, you might even say, imperialist approach. It's a very outward looking attempt to make Europe the most competitive environment in the world based on knowledge technologies by 2010. So what is happening there is that you're looking at IT as a factor for improving European competitiveness. And not just applying IT just like that, saying everybody should use IT and that's it, and then we'll be the most competitive environment. No, they've identified four key areas in this case. E-government is one of these. E-commerce, e-health and e-learning are additional ones, where the idea is that if you apply information technologies to these areas, if you make, for instance, government more efficient, or if you encourage electronic learning, then that will have an effect, a positive effect on the competitiveness of society in general. To go back to the previous ones, looking ahead, aspects which will have an impact on the e-government debate in Europe in the future are enlargement. As all of you know, there will be 10 new member states as of 1st of May next year, and there's a lot to do there to encourage or to improve the cooperation between those national administrations in these countries and those of the current EU. And I think rather interesting as well is the debate about the EU constitution, which was unveiled last week, because that foresees for the first time a European citizenship built on the Charter of Fundamental Rights. EU citizenship and the formalization of fundamental rights, such as the ability to move from one country to another, the ability to set up shop in a different country. If you define that as a European right, then national implementations can be a hurdle to the exercise of that right. So I think from this development, from the creation of a European citizenship, of the mentality that might engender in the future, you will have a requirement from the people on the ground, from citizens, from businesses, for additional services that go beyond what the member states are providing individually, and look at what the European Union as a whole can provide, can do for them. They will look, I think, more towards the EU in the future than to some of the member states for the realization or for the implementation of their European rights. That is one thing which we've been very arguing very strongly about. At the moment, if you look at e-government implementations in Europe, they tend to be very national. You look at the Netherlands, you look at Germany, you look at Italy, you look at Ireland, UK, whatever. They tend to cater for citizens of those countries. You will find very little information made available in different languages, for instance, for citizens of another country, like Spain, somebody wanting to move from one country to another. So there's a degree of accessibility there, which is very much focused on national users of these services instead of transnational, pan-European, or even international users of those services. And that is something that we've tried to argue for, that this should be changed in approaches to the implementation of e-government services. Now, not all e-government services address themselves directly to the citizens or the businesses. Most of them, or the most visible ones, do. As a citizen wanting to move from one, say, municipality to another, or wanting to enroll in university, or wanting to set up a business, that's the kind of interaction that you see between yourself and government. But there are, of course, other interactions which will never be seen by you. Those are the interactions between different government bodies, the second indent here. And thirdly, the interactions between administrations and their employees, which for the moment is not very much focused upon in the whole e-government debate. If I look at the first ones, interactions between citizens, businesses, and government on the other side. There's been, at the European level, they've established a hit parade of 20 so-called life events or business episodes, which are just a subset of all the possible interactions that you might have with government. There is a subset which has focused people's minds and people's efforts on implementing, say, the information, the data flows that you require to register the birth of a child or the death of a person or the change of name or moving from point A to point B or buying, registering a car and so on. So that's just a word to keep in mind. Life events, business episodes, those are the sort of concepts that that governments utilize to structure their interactions with citizens and businesses and to give that priority, because with the many possible interactions between all levels of government and citizens, you need to establish a priority and look at parts of these first. And as I said, these 20 have been agreed at the EU level. So those are the ones which are being implemented first of all. Now, the interactions between government bodies, as I said, not all government activities are visible to citizens and to businesses. There's a lot that governments do that has to do with securing value, securing the infrastructure, or building the infrastructure in the first place, making sure that when things go bad, such as environmental disasters, people are on hand to fix that, that the information flows to the right people, etc. And really, all of the EU debate has, in my view, unfortunately, shifted the focus of e-government implementations a little bit away from this part and more towards the citizens and business. That is unfortunate because you cannot provide services to citizens and to businesses unless there is an integration between the different government sectors. So government-to-government exchanges is the second category. The third one, as I said, is between governments and their employees. And that is something that is probably addressed at a national, at a local level, rather than at a European level. In any case, that's not something that we're very involved in. If you look at what IDA does in that context, we're very much focused on the interactions between governments. It is only recently that we started looking at the interactions between governments and citizens and businesses. In the area of interactions between governments, we focus, or there are basically two lines of actions that we pursue. One is the so-called policy-related projects, in our terminology, projects of common interest, PCIs, and the second one are the horizontal actions and measures. The point here is that the horizontal actions and measures are supposed to provide tools that can be reused in the policy-related projects. Recurring functionalities like network services or certain security services, which the policy-related projects, which are the ones adding value, which are the ones providing a service, shouldn't be implementing continuously because somebody else has already provided for them. So the idea is really to push the policy-related projects to implementing only the part that is relevant to their specific business needs and to do as much as possible implementation in the area of horizontal actions and measures. And I will give you some examples of what this means in practice. Starting first with the policy-related projects, there are about 40 of them ongoing at the moment. These are various areas in which such projects are being undertaken. In the area of transport, for instance, there's a project that looks at monitoring truck drivers' driving hours and sending that information to the administration, clearly an important factor in road safety. In agriculture and fisheries, for example, there's an application which helps monitor the fish stocks, or one should say, unfortunately these days, the depletion of the fish stocks, and makes, or tries as in any case, to prevent or to control the amount of fishing going on. In other areas, consumer protection, there are applications that look at the adverse effects of medical or pharmaceutical products. In employment, there's an application which provides cross-border job information. Just to give you a few examples of that, these projects have as a precondition for us to be able to fund them a European approach, a European legislative base, a European legal base, before we can do any action on that. So we're not looking at implementing policy projects inside the member states, but looking at what is required at European level to provide provide services in these policy areas. In the area of horizontal actions and measures, this gives you a rough breakdown of what we're doing there. You have, starting at the bottom, so-called technology solutions, and one of the most important ones that we pursue are the network services. We've built in IDA a network that connects the public administrations, or some of the public administrations, above all the federal public administrations, that connects these through a secure network that allows these administrations to exchange information that is very often sensitive, either because it contains personal data or because the disclosure of that information can be harmful to enterprises, or because in the worst of cases it can be harmful for the countries involved. That is an important point to keep in mind. The security aspects in e-government in Europe have become very much formalized in recent years. This is not just something that has happened in 2001 after the September events. It's something that has been developing over a longer period than that. But in last year, there's been a regulation from Council and from the Commission, which imposes certain procedures to follow when you build an IT system that intends to exchange sensitive information. You need to get this IT system approved by a body that is denominated by the member states. And all that is a very very complex and very long-winded affair, and you have a better chance of getting that approval. In our terminology, it's called accreditation of that infrastructure, if you can control that. And that is why, one of the reasons why we've established a private network rather than go for internet services. Staying inside the box of technology solutions, some of the other things we're doing are developing middleware applications that negotiate access to data across the different European administrations. We provide security services, or develop security services such as public key infrastructure or bridge, PKIs. And I think most importantly in the context today, we look at what interoperability measures are required to enable first of all, governments to interoperate with one another, but increasingly also what kind of interoperability measures are required to allow governments to communicate with citizens and with businesses. And of course, as you can imagine, the issue of open standards and also open source is very important in that. I will come back to that in a moment. Above that, above the technology solutions, there's a box called business applications. Unlike the technology solutions, the business applications are supposed to provide off-the-shelf solutions, integrated solutions, such as for electronic procurement or for machine translation. The final part is about spread of good practice. What can we do to make public administrations learn from one another? We organize workshops, we organize information days. Most of these for the moment are concentrated on the new, on the future member states, so the accession countries in Eastern Europe. We have our own website and something called an e-observatory, and an e-government observatory, in fact, underneath that website. There's also a mailing facility, so if you're interested in that, you can subscribe to that and find out about what's happening in the area of e-government in Europe. If I can just come back briefly to the interoperability part, application and content interoperability, because I will not touch on all of that later on, but just to give you an overview of what's happening in there. The basic document, if you like, the mother of all interoperability documents that we've drawn up is the architecture guidelines, which are now in the seventh version. You can download these from our website. The point of this is, on the one hand, to recommend certain protocols, recommend certain technology to be used in e-government implementations. But more than that, it is also to define the kind of approach that we recommend in a multi-organizational environment, because if you implement projects, e-government projects at the European level, you will not be in a position where you dictate technology. You have to accept the fact that member states or participating organizations have their own infrastructure, they have their own way of doing things. So you need to safeguard that, you need to accept that or respect the national ways of working, but nevertheless encourage everybody to maintain agreed standards, agreed ways of working, so that these boundaries, these organizational boundaries, do not become technology boundaries. Member states are doing similar things. You will be aware probably of the EGIF in the UK, the EU Government Interoperability Framework. There's something similar in France and in Germany as well. What we're doing in IDA is to look at these individual interoperability frameworks and see what is required. Do they conflict? If somebody implements a project in the UK built on based on EGIF, will this be able to interact with something built along the German guidelines, say the SAGA guidelines in Germany? We're looking at that. Is there a conflict between these? And trying to define what aspects to take into account at a European level to encourage interoperability. I think these kind of guidelines are important to you because they will give you an indication of the sorts of things to look out for if you ever want to provide a service for governments in Europe. And we've seen in recent years that with the downturn of the internet bubble, a lot of big players as well have started taking interest in e-government, seeing that as a potential market. So our approach is what we call domain-based. You accept and you respect the areas of responsibility of your partners. You respect the fact that they are going to do things within their domain the way they have decided to do that for whatever reason, and you nevertheless try to identify the measures which are required to facilitate across-domain interoperability. Now, nearing the end of the part about IDA, and then I will go on to open source. I said this already, for the project of common interest, you need a European Legal Act. Why am I saying that? We sometimes get questions from people from regions or from municipalities or even from private people who say, I've got this great idea for a project, would you have funding for that? And unfortunately, the question from the answer from our side is that unless there is a legal base, a European legal base, which says all of national administrations must work on this to provide a service to the European citizen, we cannot become active. We cannot do any funding. That is a drawback. Clearly, that limits us in what we can do. But our budget is very limited. In any case, we have 26 million euros available per year, which are divided roughly equally on the PCIs and so the projects of common interest, the policy-related project on the one side, and the horizontal actions on the other hand. On the other hand, what is, I think, quite a strong point about IDA is that all we do is coordinated with the member states. So it's not just a unit of 15 people in Brussels sitting in their offices looking at technology and saying, ah, let's do something in the area of directories. It is because it has become an issue in Europe, in the national administrations, where a European approach is required. It is because of that that we've become active. And if you look at the list of the different expert groups, there are more than 40 expert groups that take place in our context each year. It is rather broad. It goes all the way from networking to the middleware side that I've mentioned, to the interoperability issues related to metadata, to security, etc. And as you can see on the right hand, open source, it figures quite strongly in there as well. There's also an item on open document formats, which I will say a few words about in a moment, and some more business-related aspects such as electronic procurement. So that is, I think, one of the strong points of our program. We're not thinking up solutions or issues ourselves. We reflect, if you like, a common denominator of concerns of the European public administrations. Now, to the part which is probably more of interest to you. So our interest in open source software, and that relates to my first slide, is basically, or first of all, practical. We are, at first glance, not that concerned about what open source can do for European the European societies, for European competitiveness, for societal values in general. We're at first glance interested in what open source can do for our own requirements. And that is, well, I've listed a few points here. I think the most important one is that of low-cost replicability. Low-cost replicability is important because the idea of IDA is not to establish great players in one country, island solutions, you know, people that you can point and say, wow, these guys are good in doing what you're doing. The idea or the objective of IDA is to achieve a generally good level of IT usage across the European administration. So clearly, if somebody develops something which is of interest, which is useful in one country, it would be our objective, our goal to make that applicable to other administrations in other countries. And licensing costs are a big inhibitor to that, one of the main factors why we're looking at open source as an answer to how to make things replicable. Of course, we're also interested in quality solutions. One example is we operate an application which acts as a document repository for the more than 700 committees, working groups that implement European policies. There are 20,000 active users in that, and we migrated the whole thing away from a proprietary product and onto open source product because we found that they were much more performing, much more efficiently, much more strongly than the proprietary product we had previously to that. Accessibility, much has been said, and I know that GNOME is well known for upholding accessibility as a major objective. Accessibility is maybe less of an issue when you talk about government-to-government communications, simply for the fact that it is a more restricted and a more static environment with which you communicate. You know your partners. You can make the weirdest of arrangements with your partners, including the fact that you're going to exchange all documents in the Word format. That's unfortunately the case today. The commission is a purely Word, a purely Microsoft environment, and all the documents that we send out, and there are over 700,000 of these each year to the other institutions and the member states, are all Word formatted. It's a bit unfortunate, I'll come back to that. But in a sort of controlled environment, an environment which is static, meaning that you always talk to the same people, you can do that. The further away you go from that kind of controlled environment, which I've associated with the government-to-government context, the further away you go from that towards providing services to citizens and to businesses, meaning different people every time and a much vaster audience, the more accessibility becomes an issue. And the less it is acceptable that you, as a service provider, as being accountable to the public, impose certain product choices. So that is why we're very interested in accessibility, in open standards, but also in the implementation of open standards. Non-discrimination. Well, non-discrimination, first of all, is, of course, the issue that we do not want to discriminate against certain products, whether these are proprietary or open source. But at the moment, discrimination, if it happens, will always be against open source, because the proprietary products are the de facto standards, are the ones which are installed, are the ones which have the, you know, the salespeople who come to the public administration, the ones who've got the best arguments, etc., or the only arguments which are heard, I should say. But non-discrimination has, in our context, also a different perspective. Governments have outsourced most governments have outsourced IT services. And if we provide an IT solution to others, such as this document repository that I referred to, those users of that application will need to outsource support for that. And we found that until now, in the current, that is still the current situation, our products, when we give them away, are not licensed under an open source license. They're licensed under a specific license which allows only that user to have access to the source code, and for that user to empower, say, one actor from the market to provide the support for that. What we find is that, funnily enough, it's always the same companies who win the bids to provide the support to those products. For a very simple reason, they're the only ones who have access to the source code because they developed in the first place. And they're the only ones which can estimate the cost that it will take to provide the support around that. So unless you can release source code to the general public, you will never get an open market around, say, for the support or for the maintenance of these products. And that is something we discovered at our own cost, you could say. We found that our own calls to tenders are always answered to by the same companies, the ones that have been involved in the development of these applications since day one. And we failed to make, to attract other players in the market. And that is very unfortunate, and also unfortunate for the taxpayers. Now, on the one hand, our interest is practical, as I've tried to say. On the other hand, the impact of that is, or the way we have to set about implement or changing our ways is, or should be, principled. Principled in the sense that we must make measures to create a level playing field, first of all. And a level playing field means spreading the news. Now, that might sound strange to you. You've been involved in open source for years. You know the advantages, the disadvantages. You know all the products, or you know that there is at least a vastness of products which are available. But public administrations are not like that. They wouldn't necessarily. They don't read the sort of newspapers or the journals that we might read. They need to be told through credible, in their eyes, credible channels that open source is something that they should look at, and that is why we started, we did some work on that in 2001. We presented a report on open source, which looks at products, but equally importantly also looks at who's using them already in the public administrations. I think it was said earlier today, public administrations are not the most adventurous users of IT. They tend to be very conservative, and you can provide all the best arguments about an open source solution they've not seen somebody else in the public administration use that, then they will not. They will decline and say, well, there must be something wrong with that. I'm not going to be the first one to use that. Sorry?
That's being a sheep.
That's being a sheep, or the other way around, not being a hero. I would rather call those who go ahead and try and act on their belief and on their conviction in an environment which is a little bit hostile for the moment. I would rather call them heroes than call all the other ones sheep. I think it's more, it's better for promoting a change in attitude. So the other point, the other action that we intend to undertake is especially to address the point about people being afraid of not being the first to move, is to create a reference information point on open source usage in public administrations, so that, you know, public administrators, the people who are responsible for IT in a local administration or wherever, can find out that, you know, you're not going to be the first one. There's somebody else who's gone the way and who's been successful, who's not been fired and so on, who's been successful in their implementation, or even to learn about the problems that they face. So that is something that we intend to set up early next year. The other issue about promoting a level playing field is, of course, encouraging respect for open standards. That is something which we ourselves are probably not very good at. That's something where we would need to learn also from you, to the extent that you're ever interested in tendering for public administrations. If you find that the way these technical specifications are written is not open, then it is important that you let us know, because it's not necessarily of ill will that they are written the way they are, it's simply of lack of knowledge, that we don't know how to do things differently. One other point under this title, encourage respect for open standards, that we are looking at this year, is to work on an open document standard. Now, the point is not, if that is your fear, the point is not that there's going to be 10, 15 bureaucrats sitting together and doing sort of technical work to develop an open standard. Not at all. We will be the first to admit we have no understanding of the sort of technical issues that need to be addressed when you look at that. It's more to look at, you know, can we build sufficient support amongst public administrations that, after all, represent roughly 20% of purchasing power in Europe? Can we build enough political support amongst these to go to the big players and say, you know, we're fed up with your proprietary solutions. We can't use these in our interactions with the citizens. We cannot rely on these to be readable in 10, 20, 60 years' time from now. We don't like the way they're structured. We don't like their lack of support from metadata, that kind of stuff. We want to go to the commercial actors and say to them, you know, with this proposal, are you, and with our purchasing power on the other hand, Can we bend your arm to adopt these open standards? And it's first of all a political debate. The technical part will need to be addressed later on. At this level, the very first level, what we're trying to do is gauge the sort of political will that there might be amongst national administrations to go along that line. Because if that's not the case, we can stop work right there. With 26 million euros a year, you don't make much of an impression on the big players in this field. We're now going beyond simply pointing to others and saying, you know, there's good stuff out there and this guy over there has implemented that. We want to become a little bit more practical, and that is why this year we will release, probably in June or July, the person working on that is not here now, I think, so I could ask him otherwise. We're going to release guidelines, again, targeted at public administrations, guidelines for people who are interested in open source, who are interested in migrating towards open source, and providing them with some, or hopefully as complete as possible, a general overview of the issues to face when working towards migration. These are technical issues, first of all, but there are also issues related to the costs of the migration, and that is, of course, a very controversial subject. You've seen all the studies. Some say it'll cost more, others say it'll cost less. Clearly, our intention is to demonstrate that it'll cost less, but to do so by looking at real case studies or real examples of public administrations that have migrated, and assessing these and looking at what the cost factors actually are. The fourth item we're involved in, we've been involved in also already last year, is that on how to encourage software reuse. Software reuse or reuse of software which has been developed for public administrations or by public administrations. There was a report out in summer of last year which attracted some degree of interest, as these reports go, not too bad, on what would be required to encourage a pooling of software amongst public administrations. And our intention, well, we've not implemented on these recommendations as yet, for one very simple reason, and that is to do so you need a long-term perspective. If you'd like to set up a pooling facility for public administrations, you need to look at so the legal issues involved in that. You need to build up trust. You need to build up, people need to know you in order to contribute their applications to what you've done. And all that will take a number of years before it's actually usable. And the IDA program as it stands now will terminate end of next year. There might be a follow-up. But until there is a follow-up, we didn't want to take that kind of a risk and start developing something which might have to be discontinued. Nevertheless, we are starting some preparatory work on that, which will see the light of day early next year. It's an inventory of e-government-related applications, so inventory of applications which were developed for or by public administrations, which we would like to establish and encourage the reuse of that. Now, of course, reuse of applications is not going to be possible in every instance. A lot of the applications are very strongly linked to the particular legal environment in which they were built or for which they were built. There are clearly also strong linguistic factors which can inhibit the reuse of applications. And I've also been told from a developer that it takes him twice the effort to make something reusable, meaning to make it documented, to modularize it, etc., than it does to implement the first idea. So there's also kind of a reluctance on the side of people who finance the creation of applications to have this created in such a fashion, have these applications written in such a fashion that reusability is inbuilt in them, because the cost at the first stage would be bigger to having it just built for your specific purposes. But let's see how that works out. Let's see who is willing to contribute, and let's see what has actually been developed out there. We know of some e-procurement solutions which are useful. We know of middleware applications which negotiate access to data, which are quite interesting, which we're looking at the moment. There must be lots more out there which is of use to public administrations. And finally, in the area of what we're doing to encourage open source is looking at the release of EDA-funded app developments to the open source community. I've mentioned some of the factors, or one of the factors which has made us look at that, the point about opening the market around the public administrations. Our preference for the release of our applications is the GPL license, and we have started an internal consultation of our legal service. We are a public administration like everybody else, so we need to go to the legal guys and try to explain the thing to them, try to involve them in our objectives, and try to get them to be cooperative rather than just saying no or you can't do that. So we've gone to our legal service. First indications are that we will probably get the okay to release our things under GPL. There's some issues, of course, that you're familiar with, liability, how to protect yourself against that. It's not so much linked to the issue, to the question of license, it's more linked to the mechanism of the release of the application, where we probably need to find a solution, an organizational solution, for instance, in the future to make to reduce the risks of the public administration towards being sued for liability reasons. People at this stage always say, well, nobody's ever sued Microsoft and succeeded. That's true. But that's never going to convince sort of the people who are on my back inside my organization. They know that there's what they call, I think, deep pocket clients or deep pocket targets. So they want to be absolutely sure that there's no risk of liability or anything else like that when they do release applications. But as I said, things are looking fairly good. We should be able to release our applications under GPL quite soon. I know that other member states are taking a different, or other countries are taking a different approach. A lot is happening, or a lot of countries are looking at developing their own national licenses. I understand, and that's something I'd like to get your opinion on as well. I understand that that's not something that the open source communities appreciate very much. It just makes things more complex. It makes things less transparent. You know what you can expect from your licenses. You wouldn't necessarily know the repercussions of our custom-built licenses. That's something that we need to discuss at European level as well as at national level. I would think in the worst of cases, if we cannot convince the national players that they should simply use one of the existing licenses, if they are hell-bent on writing their own licenses, then we should at least avoid that there will be 15 or 25 or however many different European national licenses, and then instead look at simply a single European license. But that is, as I said, not our preference. Quick look at the time. Okay, I'll try and wind up things. I think this is even the last slide anyway. Some points which ideally I would like to get your feedback on. Things which, from my perspective, are still open issues. One is different cultures, and that's not about the fact that I'm wearing a white shirt and only a tie, taken out for today's presentation. And you, at least in this context, are not. Probably in different contexts, you will wear different things as well. That's not the point that I'm referring to. The different cultures is more the fact that public administrations, when they interact with somebody, they look at organizations. They want to have sort of things cast in contract. They want to be sure that you're here today, you're going to be there tomorrow. And they want to know that there's a fixed interlocutor, a counterpart, that you can go to when something goes wrong. They're not the ones, as I said, most of them have outsourced their IT services. Mm-hmm. They're not the ones who are going to, when a problem comes up, going to surf the net to find a solution or write to some news group and request help. That's not the way they work anymore these days. The rarest of them do, and I think it's quite interesting to see that it has been those with a lot of in-house competence, above all, which have taken up open source faster than others. Those which rely on an outsourced approach to IT are the ones which would probably be most reluctant to take up open source. That is something that you need to take into account. I'm not saying that you should, you know, become a organization, but that is something which clearly will always be in the back of your counterparts in public administrations when they deal with open source. For them, it's kind of an amorphous mass of programmers to whom they have no sort of privileged access. And I think it's a bit the other way around, but correct me if I'm wrong. There are certain differences also from your perspective. I think the open source, my confession is, in the open source community, you tend to be very personalized. You look at people, and you need somebody like a face that you know in the public administration, myself or Mr. Trollis or Mr. Reinders, wherever in the national administration, that you where you know how this guy is Mr. Open Source or Mrs. Open Source in that particular administration. Whereas the public administrations, you know, are not organized like that. I may be here today, but there may be somebody else doing that same presentation tomorrow. So that's one point I think that one would have to negotiate. And it spills directly into the procurement part. How can we procure solutions based on open source? How can we to harness the developments and the creativity that is out there whilst at the same time having a degree of control over the development. An important factor that people will always will confront you with when you say, here, I've got a great solution, is, well, will it be there in 5 years' time? Is it documented? can I impact or input my requirements on the decision process about the future evolution of that? I think there, what we haven't tried, but what we will probably go for in the future is to procure mediary services to look at, you know, is there somebody out there who gets a kind of a contract, who gets some pocket money, if you like, as well, to hand out to developers to get certain applications developed using open source solutions. Because the question is how else can we procure the vast competence that is out there individually unstructured amongst different developers or the different developer communities. The alternative is that you go to the big players like IBM and so on, who've established themselves as kind of open source competent organizations, and who appeal to public administrations because they are big organizations, because they can provide contractual framework, and because they're going to be there in 5 years' time. And that is maybe, that is, you know, that's, I think, sub-ideal, and that is not, not, I think, being that beneficial to the open source community as a larger group. The legal uncertainties, I don't think I need to cover that. I've spoken a little bit about that already. Technical aspects, that is not, yeah, I don't think the technical aspects which are specific, or the technical aspects that we are faced with in public administrations when we talk about the migration towards open source are any different from those of any other organization. So that is probably not something specific to our context. The final point is that the inversion of the sheep argument, yep, public administrations might be sheep, they might be loath to risk anything. What it takes, as I said, I prefer to look at the ones who have taken risks, is leadership, not in the sort of macho sense of the word, leadership in the sense of people who are persuaded by the usefulness, the benefits of open source, that they go out there and act on their beliefs and demonstrate to others that it can be done. And I think there will be plenty of people like that. At tomorrow's event, there's going to be Tony Carey from the Beaumont Hospital, who's done a great job at migrating towards open source. There will be lots of experience from some of the member states as well, so I do hope you will be there and encourage them to go on with that and encourage others who have not taken that step yet to try open source and move away from a proprietary environment. That's basically my presentation, but I do hope that there's some questions or comments if I can take home from your side. So if there's anything anybody would like to comment, please go ahead. I think you're going to get a mic.
Hi, I was wondering, is it possible for you guys to tell us what you want instead of going through the actual legal kind of tendering process,
yeah,
just to tell us directly so that we can develop, or Zinnian can develop, or somebody can develop solutions for you open source and then you use them?
Would you like to add to that, or do you have another quick? Okay. Whilst there are not that many of them, I'll go one-on-one. Yes, it'd be nice, but our problem is, who do we go to? We've for a long time wanted to establish a dialogue, if you like, between ourselves as kind of representing the public administrations and the open source community. But who do we go to? Who represents the community? Who is accepted by the community as representing them? I know that in the UK there's some sort of nation dialogue between the Office of the e-Envoy and the open source community there. We'd be happy to do the same at the European level. So if you have a proposal how to do that organizationally, I'd be happy to take that home and to discuss that with our partners in the member states.
Hi there. Yeah, I actually have an answer to that question as well. So, there is something called Open Forum Europe that is trying to be the body that you're looking for. However, they kind of missed a step, which was understanding open source in a deep way before they started talking. But they're getting better. And OSI, Open Source Initiative, which is the entity that makes sure licenses are open, is talking to them now. And we're also trying to bring the Free Software Foundation in to talk to them so that they have a better idea. They basically, they were missing some pieces of the equation, like the tragedy of the commons was lost on them somewhat, but they're getting there. And they're trying exactly to be what you're talking about, which is a place that you can go to try to get answers. So.
Change on our side is that we have to be transparent and open in our dealings with you guys. For instance, we throw the door in the face of private companies that come and knock on our doors and want to say, I represent this and that, and I'd like to talk to you about, you know, this business opportunity that you represent to us. Say, no, guys, go away, because we have to give every actor an equal access to the information that might be valuable to them. And so that goes, of course, also for the open source environment, where we would have to speak to you, speak to the KDE people and whoever else is out there, which is why I need to learn about, you know, who's representative, who are the bodies out there that we can talk to, and then to bring them all together and jointly demonstrate or discuss what our requirements are, what your possible interest in addressing these requirements might be. Mike, is somebody...
Well, as you said, you have to be equal to everybody. Then it would be a wise idea to collect an expert meeting between, let's say, the several open source communities, because there are a lot of them, and the interested governments and you itself. I think that's a good idea.
The licensors would be or might be aware of you and the other parties who be in the dialogue, which means if you choose carefully the license the way you want to, you might be able to work with other people who lead you to the way of living in a community like us, like software or open source initiative, or even the huge companies like IBM and things like that.
Yes, certainly the choice of license that we will make will have an impact or will reduce the players that we could interact with. But that is just going to be our choice. And what we're talking about here, you know, other member states or administrations might make a different choice. And what we're talking about here is establishing a broader dialogue between public administrations per se and the open source people on the other hand, so you cannot assume that everybody is going to favor the GPL licenses, as is our intention to do. But of course you're right, it will have an impact on the sort of people you're going to talk to, the choice of license.
Especially on standards and open standards.
Yeah.
How much clout do you actually hold in your...
How much clout do we have?
Yeah, how much weight do you hold in European policies? I just know nothing about that information.
No, it's a very valid point. We will see, the best example or the best demonstration of our clout will be whether we make progress in this area of open document format. On our own, zero, none. It's persuasive, and that means it's always acting towards, if you like, the least common denominator. We're not, you know, that, if you look at open source and the situation in Europe, there's some countries which are quite advanced, others which are more reluctant. And it'll always be a mix. We'll never be able to go with the most advanced ones in the fastest way. That's clear. So that responds a little bit to your question. But it's not kind of an organized body of, you know, opinion of a homogenous opinion going out there and saying, we together, we represent this and that many billions of euros, and we're going to, as public administration per se, confront the 5G vendors. That's certainly not the case. I'm told that the time's up. People are waiting for the next presentation, so maybe we should stop it there. Thank you for the few of you who are there.